history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories out there just waiting to be told. And we're never going to know unless we take a little initiative. The idea, of course, is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom, and in the process, to learn a lot. We're continually educated, entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. They're all so meaningful. They all add to our perspective. And when it comes to our view of freedom, the stories from ex-prisoners of war, those that had to live in the absence of freedom, can really jolt our reality. That was the case for me when I first met Jack Schwartz, who spent more time as a prisoner in World War II than America actually spent at war. Not long after interviewing Jack on Hometown Heroes, I received an odd-shaped package in the mail. Inside, a beautiful wooden bowl he had turned on his lathe, a skill he continued to practice until he was 102. I watched Jack fly out on an honor flight to Washington, D.C., grinning ear to ear as the assembled crowd sent him off with a special serenade on his 99th birthday. I got to see that same smile when he cut birthday cake with his fellow ex-prisoners of war for birthdays 100, 101, 102, and 103. And I was with him less than 2 months ago for National POW MIA Recognition Day. He was one of those people you almost expect to live forever and have an active, involved life forever. And he almost did, really. Jack passed away November 7th at the age of 103, and today's program is dedicated to him. Before we hear some of his World War II story, let's hear from his son, Jack Schwartz Jr.
Well, I'm going to remember the fact that he was a really, really good father growing up, but he never talked about his younger years very much. I knew, of course, he went to Caltech and stories about that, but he really never talked about his time as a POW when I was growing up. And because he lived so long, you know, back 30 years ago, after he retired, he started opening up about it. And he started getting involved with ex-POW functions and American Defenders of Bataan Corregidor functions, which I never knew about. He started telling me about them. And then when we went to Japan in 2014, that's when I found out that he had a diary that he had transcribed. And I read it on the way over. And listening to my dad during that week in Japan, together with the other prisoners of war, really allowed us to get closer than just a parent-child type of thing growing up. So I was really fortunate that he lived as long as he did.
That is Jack Schwartz Jr. talking about his late father, who we're going to listen back to now. Jack's story began in San Francisco less than a decade after the devastating 1906 earthquake, which his mother had survived.
She told me about it. They had to live in Golden Gate Park for quite a while. But that's not all she ever told me.
And I hear you were quite the whiz kid, huh?
Meaning what?
You were extremely intelligent.
Well, I guess so, because back in those days, they didn't have kindergarten, so I was learning at home. And finally, my father insisted that I get into school before I was six, even though six was the usual time. So they put me in the first grade. 2 weeks later, they put me in the second grade. So I guess that indicates something. I actually don't remember learning to read at home, but I must have, obviously.
Yeah, that's got to be a record for the shortest time spent in first grade there. That's pretty impressive. But as a young boy, something you had to deal with very early on, and you dealt with plenty in World War II, but I guess the first big thing that you had to deal with was the death of your father when you were just 10 years old?
Yeah, I was 10 when he died. Very suddenly had a heart attack, fell right over, and that was it. So after we got over that, my mother and a sister from Seattle moved down to Los Angeles. Actually, we lived in Hollywood. I went to LeConte Junior High School and Hollywood High School. I got out of Hollywood High School when I was just 15.
How'd you pull that off? 15 years and a high school graduate. How'd you do that?
Well, actually, this is funny, too. I was still in San Francisco. I was in the sixth grade, and the same teacher taught the seventh grade. So she said, let's skip the sixth and go to the seventh. So I was never in the first or sixth grade, really. Uh-huh. That's how it came about. Actually, I think it's much better now. They give higher-rated courses to people that are ahead of time instead of skipping. Your social life is actually followed up. When you're in high school and you're 15, you're graduating, I never went to a prom, for instance. So it was good, but it had its drawbacks, too.
It sounds like you had an interest at a very young age in being an engineer. Is that something that there was a moment you remember where that really became clear in your mind, that you had an ability in that direction?
I don't recall the exact time. It was early on. I think, like most boys, I wanted to be a farmer when I was a kid, a fireman. I got over that, but I forget. I was still in high school when I decided to take up civil engineering, and my original thought was to go to UC Berkeley because they have a very good engineering school there. But I still remember this sort of funny because we took my final exam in trigonometry when I was in high school. I got 100%. The teacher wrote good. So I went to him and said, what do you have to do to be better than good? So I said, Jack, you're pretty smart, but I don't think you're smart enough to get into Caltech. I'd never even thought about going to Caltech, but that was a challenge. So I took up the challenge and got admitted to Caltech. In those days, they didn't have the SAT. That didn't exist then. So those that applied had to go over to Pasadena, take 2 8-hour days of testing, and they picked out the top 160 because that was the class size. And I was selected. So I guess my math teacher was wrong. But that's the reason I went, practically why I got interested there. I'm glad I did.
So you were at Caltech at age 15?
Well, actually, before school started, I turned 16. Probably the youngest one of the class. And it's not an easy school, I'll tell you that. But I worked hard, had good memories of it. I got out in 1935, and things were all that middle of the Depression, really. So I stayed on for another year to get a master's degree. They gave me a teaching fellowship, so I got free tuition, which wasn't a big deal, but the tuition in those days was $100 a quarter. That's how times change. The summer after my bachelor's degree, four of the civil engineering students and our surveying professor went to Palomar Mountain, and we surveyed the top of the mountain where the telescope is now. So that was my first engineering check, and it was signed by Robert Millikan, the head of Caltech. I wish I had it, but they didn't have Xeroxes in those days either.
So you guys did the surveying so they could construct that big observatory on top of Palomar Mountain.
Yeah, we did it. I suspect now with all the techniques they have, they could do it better in an hour probably, but sometimes change.
When did it occur to you that joining the Navy and being an engineer for the Navy was a good idea?
It's another funny one. I was working for the Division of Highways up in Northern California, and out of the clear blue, I got a letter from the Navy asking if I was interested in joining the Navy Civil Engineering Corps as an ensign. It sounded all right, so I said yes and applied, and then it came back and said, sorry, you're too young. So that was that. You had to be, I think, 24, and I was 21. And the next year, I said, well, they wrote me another letter. I said the same thing. Meantime, I changed jobs, so another opportunity came up with the Army Engineers, which was really a very good job. I moved down to Los Angeles and worked for the Army Engineers there. They were designing the linings for the L.A. River. Back then, the L.A. River was just open on all sides. Anytime it was it flooded all over the place. And they were designing these concrete walls, which you can see now. The Navy was recruiting civil engineers again. You could apply for that. Well, at that time, I was 24. This sounds funny. So I did apply for it and gave my background. You had to go clear back to Washington, D.C. at your own expense to take the test, which I did. I think they said there were 5 openings, and they had screened everybody out, and 55 applicants were back there in Washington. So they called us in and said, well, you know, there's 55 of you here. We've screened you. You're all good, but there's only 5 appointments. How about joining the reserves? So I said, fine. Everybody said fine, I think. Guess what? I'm a year too young. You had to be 25 to be a reserve civil engineer. But here I was, 24, applying for a Lieutenant JG, which is the next step up. So I said, you know, this is funny. How about a waiver? They gave me a waiver. So here again, I was the youngest civil engineer JG in the Corps. And I did join up. And it was in July of 40 that I got a telegram asking me, and I quote this, I still remember it. Will you accept duty at Pearl Harbor in the 14th Naval District? So I looked that up. Sounded great. I mean, who doesn't want to go to Hawaii? So I said, fine, and I accepted. And a lot of funny things happened after that. All of the projects were being built by civilian engineers. And the Navy was just in charge of the construction, overseeing, seeing they did the project right and stuff like that. Actually, at Pearl Harbor, I was not involved in any really big project, just a bunch of little projects. That was going along fine. I was married. I shipped my wife over, and we were enjoying life in Honolulu. Everybody said, don't turn the island too fast because you're going to be here a long time. Well, I wasn't there a long time. Suddenly, they said, you're being transferred to Guam. I didn't know that once they got in the Navy, they could do what they wanted. I found out the hard way. So we moved out to Guam in January of 41, and life was pretty simple there. In fact, I think there were more ox cars than there were automobiles. I'm not joking. It was really a backward place.
So you've got your wife with you in Guam. You're a young married couple. Did you have a sense, an awareness, an anticipation that war might be coming?
At the time, no. But later on, in October of 41, they shipped all the families home. And that sure, that was a wake-up call. Yeah. In other words, it was the government was sure there was going to be a war, even though there wasn't.
But that didn't occur to you at the time?
Well, it did when they shipped the families home, sure.
So in October of 41, your wife gets sent back to the States and you're left on Guam. That had to be difficult for you.
Well, it wasn't all that difficult. But the only women left there were five Navy nurses, and they left one wife there didn't get shipped back, and she was something like 8 months pregnant. They didn't want her on the ship. So when the war started, she was captured along with the rest of us.
So on Guam, I would assume that similar to at Pearl Harbor, your job would entail designs and construction projects there on Guam to build infrastructure for the Navy and other branches?
That's exactly right. The big project we had was a new breakwater for Apra Harbor. It's a beautiful harbor now, but it was unprotected from storms. And the biggest project we had was building the breakwater, which, of course, was not finished when I was there. It was finished eventually. Designed some houses, swimming pools, bleachers for ball games. Practically nothing in the way of defense. In fact, there were no defense projects going on. Congress back then didn't want to upset the Japanese, and they gave no money to Guam for any defenses. Sounds funny now, doesn't it? But anyhow, that's the way it was.
Would you say that in this period, what, about a year and a half that you were in the service before the war started, that it was a bit of an adventure for you, that you were seeing parts of the world and feeling fulfilled in your work and a pretty carefree existence?
Actually, I was very happy there. It was easy living and happy at my work. Yeah, it was very good. If the war hadn't started, it would have been great, but it did start.
And when did you catch wind of that? What happened on Guam? What was the atmosphere there on December 7th, 1941?
Well, actually, it was December 8th, 1941. I crossed the date line.
Good point. So December 8th on Guam, December 7th in Honolulu.
That's right. The first thing we knew was, after my wife went home, another civil engineer moved in with me in the same house. We had a maid and cook for $25 a month, you can imagine. But anyhow, we got a call about 5 in the morning. Not we, but the headquarters got a call from Pearl Harbor saying hostilities have started. Those were the words. Then I found out they didn't say a Pearl Harbor event attack, but they found that out real quick. So everybody on staff got called. We rushed down to headquarters to see the captain, who was also the governor of the island. The defense plans for Guam, it was called the Rainbow Plan in those days, was just to do nothing. We were meant to surrender. There were no defenses. There were 100 Marines on the island, but they were mostly policemen for the island. So we knew we'd be captured at that point, just a matter of when. And for a couple of days, they sent planes over Guam and dropped a few bombs. There was a minesweeper called the Penguin, and they sank that. And a number of officers men were killed on that. And on shore, I'm not sure anybody was killed by the bombing. A few people were hurt. All we could do in the civil engineering was destroy all the equipment that was being used to construct the breakwaters. It was huge construction equipment. We blew out the motors and stuff on that.
So it wouldn't be used against you?
Yeah, so it couldn't be used by the Japanese. They probably could have put new motors in, but at least we did what we could.
I know this was a long time ago, but your memory clearly is very sharp. Most people haven't been in that position where they find out that in a major way it's hopeless. There's no chance of not getting captured, that this is inevitable. But how did you deal with that as a young man with your wife back in the States to have that realization, you know what, I'm going to become a prisoner of the Japanese or die trying not to be? How did you handle that and process that at the time?
We were all just in a a hell of a spot, and with nothing we could do. And we used to joke before that about eating rice and fish heads. We didn't realize we wouldn't get the fish when we go to Japan. But I can't recall any special thoughts on it.
Do you think it was a blessing or a curse to know in advance before you were captured that that was going to happen? Do you think it helped prepare you for it, that you had a little advance understanding of what was about to happen?
No, I don't think so, because we had no idea what it was like to be a predator. When the Japs did come in, they landed on a couple of beaches. There were nobody defending the beaches. This was all in the dark. It was early in the morning, and I was in my office in the same building that they had. It was called the Plaza. It was an old Spanish building, because you probably know the Spanish had the island before, up until 1898, when the U.S. took it over after the Spanish-American War. Typical Spanish construction, the walls were about 3 feet thick, and my office was down there on the ground floor. The Japanese troops finally came to the Plaza. It was a group of Chamorros who were the island patrol under the command of a Navy chief. And they were set up on the Plaza with a machine gun from World War I, I'm sure. We started hearing firing, not an awful lot. And finally it stopped, and we stayed quiet. It was still dark, and I wasn't about to walk out and see what was happening. And it turned out, I know this for a fact, that the governor sent the executive officer down to offer to surrender. They made him drop his trousers and everything, stand there naked, but he did surrender. I'm sure a lot went out there. I've read about one out there in the Plaza, but I didn't witness it because I was literally hiding until it was light. Anyhow, I came out with light with my hands up, and there they were. All the prisoners were all rounded up, Japanese Marines. These were not kids. These were experienced soldiers. You might remember, maybe you don't, the Japanese started war in 1932 in Manchuria and in China, so they had very experienced troops. They saw us come out, and they stopped. In my pocket, I had a 5-inch slide rule. Nobody uses slide rules anymore. And this fellow took it out of his rack, looked at it, put it back in my pocket, saw my watch, didn't take my watch, and just rounded us up. Later on, they moved us all to a Catholic church, and that's where they kept us the month we were on Guam.
That would be the first of 45 months that Jack Schwartz would spend as a prisoner of war. He would mark his next four birthdays in captivity. Jack passed away November 7th at the age of 103, and we honor his legacy on a weekend in which he'll be buried at Santa Nella National Cemetery. We'll hear Jack's POW story and more from his son Jack Jr. when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.